I just want to get by, make some art, and like be a good person and enrich other people's lives, mm-hmm. and, you know, love authentically and don't hurt anybody. And I married the love of my life. And as long as, you know, and this might be naive as well, but as long as there's some real fortifying emotional content to cultivate with another person or people for that matter, yeah, maybe I work at the sign store mm-hmm. for that's what I'm qualified to do until I cultivate some other skills. Mm-hmm.
My daddy wants you to know a lot of the episodes have mostly clean language, but this episode has some words in it that aren't meant for all ages. So if you have kids like me in your house, you may want to put some headphones on for this one. You've been warned. Done, done, done.
Gotcha. Go on.
Karibuni, which is welcome in Swahili. Welcome, everybody, to the Daddy Unscripted podcast. My name is Tim Wheaton. I am the podcast creator and the host. And I'll just let you guys know, because there are definitely going to be some new people here to listen to this episode with Tom Keeley, I just open every episode with a welcome in a different language, because that's my way of helping make the world a smaller place where we're all able to say welcome to one another in each other's languages or something like that. But anyways, welcome to the Daddy Unscripted podcast. If you are here for the first time, I'm very excited to have you be a part of this conversation with Tom and myself. Tom is the guitarist of the band Thursday, which is fairly recently reunited, I guess you would say. And Tom and the band Thursday are actually about to go out on the road. They start their tour for this year out in March in Australia, and then they'll be working their way back through the United States after that. And I'm actually really excited to go see them in April. So if you are able to get yourself to a show, make sure you do that. Check them out, Thursday.net, to find out when they're playing. But in this episode, Tom and I are talking not so much about his band and music. We're talking a lot more about his childhood, his time with his parents, his dad and his mom, and separately as well as together, and what that brought to his table with him becoming a new dad within the last 2 years, and the difficulties of that role change for him and how he does that amongst being a, let's just say it, being a rock star. So without too much further information, and just so you can listen to him tell his story, let's get right to the episode with Tom Keeley. There were some good life lessons in that, especially, and as you learn how to be very sure about zipping up your zipper. Some of those other important life lessons you may not get from to bring it to the podcast, that you may not have gotten that from your dad. I don't think my dad ever told me, make sure that you are zipping your zipper up slowly if you're going commando.
You know, I feel like that might be something my dad actually said to me. One of the few things he actually warned me about, you know, I've now that I'm a dad, I've been cultivating my catalog of awful dad jokes, much to the chagrin of my wife, who will not humor them whatsoever.
Oh, and she's got so many more years to live through those.
Man, it's, as far as the legal system in Maryland is concerned, she's at least 50% obligated to humor my insufferable stunted, or what is it when you stop growing as an emotional person? Basically, my base, you hit 27 and everything starts slowly unraveling, so slow that you don't even notice it until 15 years later. You look back and you're like, oh crap, this whole time, that's my underwear has been showing this whole time, or whatever it is.
Which is so funny, because if you think about when, and I don't remember the actual facts and figures on this, and I haven't hired a fact checker for my podcast yet, but when your brain is actually fully formed is something like 22 for men or something like that. So the amount of time that you have from hitting your fully formed brain to when that starts to erode is so minimal.
Oh, God.
We really should have more time.
That's so sad. It must be true.
Yeah. To each his own on when everything starts kind of evaporating and eroding. But supposedly, yeah, the fully formed brain is like somewhere between 20 and 23.
See, that makes me think of two things. One, why did I work so hard in my 20s, like on self-improvement and like meditation and reading and all of this stuff? I had identified the things I didn't want to be in the world. And I spent my entire 20s trying to like work on my stuff. That's the first, I think, like, oh, great. Like efforts and exercises in futility, now that you mention it. And that's A. And B, I heard somewhere once years ago, a more comforting, strangely more comforting concept that you are essentially who you are by the time you're six.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I was a pretty good guy when I was six. Like, mm-hmm. I could deal with that. I've got a sense of innocence still, you know, unlost, untainted. Right. Just like
you just kind of warned me that I have 1 year left to basically turn around my son.
Oh man, dude, now's the time. Well, they also say with kids who are like, you know, when do you have the big conversations with your kids about like drugs and sex and whatever else? Mm-hmm. And I think it goes something along the lines of like, if you're starting to think about having the conversation, you probably already should have had it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is weird for me because my son is 18 months old and I'm already thinking like, man, he's not ready to talk about this.
I don't
think
he's ready for this yet.
Yeah. I'm primed with all of my anxiety. I don't want to freak this kid out, but
yeah, yeah. Well, now plus I mean, that all has changed so much, A, since when I was walking uphill in the snow both ways, barefoot to school.
Which you were. You definitely were.
Yeah, here in sunny Southern California. We didn't hear about any of that stuff until much later than they do nowadays.
Right.
I mean, it's scary to think about. And not, you know, across the globe and in every school and in every neighborhood, but in general speak, some of the stories that I hear about what kids are talking about and involved in at a very young age. I mean, look, like nowadays in high schools, not to scare any parents who aren't aware of this and who have high schoolers or are about to, but the fact that heroin is like the drug of choice of high school aged kids is ridiculous to me. Yeah. Like,
that was definitely the bad kids did that. And there weren't very many of them. It was like, mm-hmm. Oh, what's his face does that? Stay away.
Yeah.
You know, I recall my high school graduation day and, you know, I ran to the restroom right before the ceremony and, you know, these three kids who I've been going to school with for 4 years came out of the bathroom. I'm like, oh, yep, those are the heroin dudes standing on the precipice of the rest of our lives. And, you know, they're getting high in heroin.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I was always too terrified to even consider that a viable reality. You know, heroin was like, it is terrifying. It was terrifying. And I hope it's terrifying for you know, my kid, when it happens. But yeah, it's blasé. And not, you know, we won't get into the systemic, causal elements at play with pharma and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it's tragic.
Yeah, it's the escalation and the boredom, really, like, honestly. And it doesn't help how much everybody sees what everybody is doing across, you know, the world, really, because, you know, when you're in rural America in 1970, you're not necessarily knowing what other kids are trying to ramp up what they are doing in New York City or whatever it may be. And you're just doing what you're doing. And then it's going from dropping Mentos in a Coke bottle days to like
you can get high off of that.
No, but
okay.
You can get an emotional high off of it.
It's explosive.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's weird, man. I spent a lot of my youth in rural New Jersey, and middle school up until freshman year in high school, like it was very rural New Jersey, you know, one intersection town.
Oh, wow.
A couple hundred people lived there. My class was like 35 or some odd kids. And then we would, you know, our school and a bunch of other schools would all be sent to the main high school in Central, Hunterdon Central. So you'd have four schools going to a more metropolitan area, which was also just farmland, undeveloped farmland. Mm-hmm. But I moved, you know, my dad was the summer before my freshman year, I found out that we were moving to Flemington, New Jersey, which was the town where the high school was, 15 minutes up the road from the middle of the woods, Surgeonsville, New Jersey, where we lived prior. And, you know, it was a 15 minute drive, but it was an actual town. You know, I moved out and I found that the kids who stayed there through high school, just 15 minutes down the road, they were stuck in all of the cycles of like serious abuse, serious drug abuse, just by, you know, you would think that a life of like living outside and fishing and, you know, doing
right.
Farm stuff. I mean, I find it, that sounds wonderful to me now, but
yeah, yeah.
for an anxiety riddled teen. Yeah. And those kids they went to our high school, but they lived in the woods and they got stuck. They either became like computer engineers, widely successful people, or got really, really stuck.
Mm-hmm. So you're living in New Jersey and you're born and raised there. What is has your family been there before you were born for a long time or no?
Yeah, it's a little convoluted. My dad's family, as far back as I know, is New Jersey all the way. Yeah, great-grandparents, grandparents, you know, fairly picturesque, not without flaws, but, you know, like American dream family living in New Jersey. And my mom, on the other hand, came from this weird world of old money, and she was raised... She's one of seven siblings. They had seven nannies. They lived in the Philippines and North
Carolina. Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was a very different deal. And my parents met in college, got married, were married for a few years, had my sister and myself. But as far as I've ever experienced, you know, they got divorced, I think, when I was two. And so we lived with my mom for the formative years, which I remember pretty vividly in Maryland. Her family had moved to Maryland on the Eastern Shore while she was in college. And so that's where we were, my sister, myself, and my mom, up until we started moving more. We moved to North Carolina. We moved probably 15 or so times between my first memory and the start of third grade.
Wow.
Yeah. She was,
that's a lot. Moved.
Yeah. It was fun. Crazy, but fun. And so, yeah, no, New Jersey, I say when people ask me where I'm from, I first automatically say, oh God, where am I from? And then I remember I spent the majority of my life from 88, through college in New Jersey. So really I'm from New Jersey. Mm-hmm. While my dad's family, yes, was firmly rooted there, I don't completely identify with that because it was such a cluster in the beginning.
Yeah. Did your dad separate from your family during that time when you were little?
Yeah, it's weird. I don't really have any memories of him. Well, that's not true. I actually have a lot of memories of him. But yeah, I've tried to dive through back through the annals of history with various family members just so I can get a clearer picture of what was actually going on back then. And the sense that I get is that you know, dad was in New Jersey working for his dad at the accounting firm on the straight and narrow. Mom was and still is the, you know, quintessential Woodstock flower child, maybe rich kid. I'm not exactly sure, because you can't really get a straight answer from her how that comes into play. But yeah, they were, you know, they fell madly in love, and the logistics of these two personality types coexisting long-term sort of, well, led where it led. They had to get separated. And we stayed with mom, and dad stayed in New Jersey, you know, working.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird, because we were in, I remember being in private school in kindergarten and first grade, which now I come to learn, of course, is incredibly expensive. And I think, like, mom, how did you do that? You were a bartender who was partying all the time. Like,
yeah, yeah.
And so you start to realize the reach of extended family and that support system. And, you know, because most of my memories are from after the time we were in, you know, shirt and tie private school, and the time shortly after leaving that and going into the wilder reaches of feral, poor people life. I'm sure you can attest to, you know, the lack of regulation.
Oh, yeah.
When we were young people, it was definitely feral. A lot of moments in hindsight that I realize, not only it's a miracle that I survived, but it's a miracle that anybody survived.
Right. Yeah, that's the childhood of the 70s and 80s is riddled with people who are still here who really should have died in some silly stunt that they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
Unsupervised.
Yeah, completely unsupervised. Not like the parents were necessarily far away, but they just weren't looking at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I couldn't swim, but I was definitely doing lots of water stuff. Mm-hmm. On the eastern shore of Maryland, you're kind of always near water. And I mean, I can't count on one hand the number of events that transpired in my early years where I thought, wow, I should have just died. I will never speak of this to anyone again, mm-hmm. ever. No one will ever know. And I'll just pretend like it never happened.
and but hopefully not too many people saw it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no one ever saw it. And if any friends were around when they saw it, I wasn't allowed to like hang out with them anymore.
Right.
You know, their parents somehow were paying attention to them, but mine weren't to me. Mm-hmm. And so I was considered, I guess, a bad kid, even though I was just confused and like not trying to do bad stuff. Just no one ever told me, you know, don't walk out on that ice or don't ride your big wheel down the dock. I had that Knight Rider big wheel with the skid out bar where you pull the brake and you do that really cool 180 or 360 if you had enough speed, as if just like uncontrollable inertia 360, like spinning out of control, wasn't dangerous enough. They had to add pyrotechnics.
Yeah. As you're saying all of that, I'm thinking about the difference between some parents now and some parents then. And I'm sure, again, like this has the quality of some generalizations and whatnot, but I think there are way more bubble wrap parents out there that I see visibly than, you know, when I was a kid or when I was a teenager or even a young adult. Like, there wasn't as much helicopter parenting going on. I mean, especially when I was a kid, like, even though my parents were fairly active and, you know, I was the youngest of eight. So
wow.
How many eyes do two parents have? That's impossible to do, basically.
Yeah.
Oh, so we had a nanny when I was really little, and, you know, we would have rotating nannies who watched us, but that was fairly, I would say, almost a joke with a few of them because they were young girls who, you know, I remember not seeing them at many different times and for quite a while. I remember one of them. I have some very interesting memories from my nannies, and one I don't know how much I should get into. One of them, her boyfriend attempted suicide, and I was with her, and he had, I think, potentially slit his wrists or whatever. And there was, we went to their home where they were, and there was blood like all over the kitchen when we arrived, and she didn't know anything had happened whatsoever and was like freaking out. And I'm a, I don't know, maybe 4 year old kid who's with her, like witnessing all of this. And so, yeah.
Welcome to the world, little dude.
Yeah, exactly. So the quality of nannies that we were having, some of them, I should say, were questionable.
Yeah, man, that's crazy, dude.
Yeah.
That, like, I'm sorry that happened to you. That's like, that's cool first memories.
Right. Yeah.
Mom and dad, thanks.
This is what authority figures are. Oh, it's funny too, because my mom, I tell her any of these stories. Actually, it was just, she just turned 86 on Pearl Harbor Day, and two of my brothers and I went over and had lunch with her, and one of them was telling a story, maybe of him like cheating on a test or something like that. And anytime anything negative comes out, my mom is like, please, just, I don't want to hear about that stuff. I just, right. She loves living in this memory or dream world of everything was perfect and nothing happened on or off her watch that was untoward, you know?
Well, of course, you know, these people who are in charge of us are, as I'm finding or experiencing now, are clueless. Mm-hmm. You know, we're armed with information, whatever bit of information we could possibly need to find, we can find it in under a minute. You know, like I jokingly lament, you know, I never wore a seatbelt, never had a bike helmet, blah, blah, blah. Like no one was ever paying attention. That was only dialed up 1,000% for them. You know, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. I think of my mom, I tried to be mad at my mom for certain things as a 20 something, and like actually had to sit down with her to like go over the laundry list of things that I thought we should address. Mm-hmm. And there's some stories there, but you know, the long story short of that specific interaction was like, oh man, like you had it worse.
Mm-hmm.
Like your mom didn't even like you.
right. Yeah.
You know, like your dad loved you. Your mom was like, she wasn't trying to hang out with seven kids. You know, she told me stories of like being in the Philippines and running across with her sister, running across like an old fashioned log jam, like, you know, the logging industry where you have all the giant trees floating down the water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would run across the channel, the logs, and saw a dead body. You know, the cops busted them and are like, hey, you entitled rich white people.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see, you want some reality? Like, look under this blanket. Here's a dead body.
Oh gosh.
You know, like, and right. I think, you know, I used to sneak out a lot, but it never
not to got, that extent,
not to that level.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's crazy that the stuff that I worry about safety wise and like quality of life for my son, that these conditions that we want to provide for our children as, you know, with the ages that we are in 2018, those just weren't considerations not too long ago. Mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. modern world, you know, kids were supposed to figure it out. And I'll jokingly ask a friend, or someone will jokingly mention to me, like, what did people do? And I think, like, well, they died.
right, exactly.
You know, they got sick and they died, or they didn't have the amenity that like made life better. They just suffered. That's just what happened.
But, yes. And the tough thing too is like, as you are now thinking about those things with your 18-month-old, by the time he is 5 and really like verbal and doing all of those things, how much different those things that you're kind of looking around and thinking about and seeing a 5-year-old dealing with, like, how much of that is going to be accelerated or extinct or whatever when he is five.
Man, this the stuff that I have on my my short list of things to worry about, it's not even going to be like that's going to be rated G by the time
he's
modern world dangers, trials and tribulations. It's going to, I always thought, you know, growing up, like, I'm going to be such a cool dad. I'm going to wear the same clothes I'm wearing right now, which I think are kind of cool. I'll never age. I'll always feel confident. I'll just teach my kid to be brave and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you get to now and it's like, oh my God, I'm so scared. Like my clothes aren't cool anymore. Like at least the least important of the entire list, my self-image, but you know, but being prepared for what's to come, I really don't think that there's any way to do it based on any metric, on most metrics I thought would be important.
Right.
I mean, there are some that will hold true forever that are universal, but yeah, like heroin's going to be, I don't know. There's going to be something way worse than heroin, way more insidious that I don't even know about.
Yeah. I mean, there was that period of time with bath salts, for God's sake. Like, what are people going to be coming up with to ingest or, you know, alter their state of mind for funsies that they just aren't really thinking through properly on, oh, there are possible consequences with this or whatever, you know. That's this, I think for me as a parent, that's kind of the scariest thing of like the immediacy of what an okay answer can lead to, you know?
Yeah. Well, and as long as people have been trying to get high, they've been using whatever is around them. Like, I think like, man, I'm sure my kid is going to experiment with something. I just hope it's like something classy. No,
right.
Like, just don't do that cat spray, man.
Yeah. Don't make me explain to the other parents. I'm really sorry that my kid talked your kid into smoking cat urine.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know where he got that from.
Kids will be kids. I'm like, I don't, kids are those kids? Like, kids will be kids in that way? That's, that's insane. But it happens. And I guess part of it is preemptively freaking yourself out to the point where nothing can, where you become inflappable, you know? Like, and I'm not saying by point-to-point wear and tear where you do every drug and you have every experience to where you're numb or been there, done that. But, you know, get creative, conceptualize, because when you get a call to the office because your kid has gotten into some trouble in 15 years from now, it's probably going to be for something you're not prepared to deal with.
Right. Well, and you do all that work to hopefully prep your children for making smart choices and the right decisions, but like you're not, you know, parents, again, to the bath salt thing, 10 years ago weren't sitting their kids down before that took place and saying, just in case you ever get the desire, like you probably shouldn't ingest bath salts or snort them, and you know, don't drink from the WD-40 can, like you know. There's those things of, okay, clearly these kind of things you should not be trying. And I'm hopeful that my kid doesn't, you know, try to, I don't know, melt down coins and shove them in their veins and think that that's going to be cool.
Well, I mean, I imagine, and I don't know yet because I obviously haven't had these conversations with my son, but, you know, I've talked about it with my wife, who is way more intelligent than I am. And, you know, we haven't totally figured it out, but it's like, don't talk to your kid about drugs are bad, drugs are this, you know, you're a bad person. You know, talk to them about self-worth and everything that happens before they get the urge. Instill a sense of respect for others, respect for safety, respect for themselves, you know, do no harm, sort of like a Hippocratic oath, I'm imagining.
Yeah.
You know, where you do no harm, because those urges are going to happen whether you want them to or not. You can't really do anything about that.
Right.
My best guess is that you prime them with a good sense of self and, like, you know, get a head on their shoulders. So when the urge inevitably, or whenever that intersection inevitably happens, they're not flying into it blind, like blasé or cavalier, like whatever, like, you know.
Yeah.
Just this one time, it's so dumb. It's like, well, yeah, well, the one time is the one time with heroin in our generation and generations.
Exactly. Before,
like, that's all it takes.
Yeah. That's why I say, like, that one time that you basically sometimes will say, oh, okay, I'll try this. Like, and if I don't like it, then I won't do it again. Well, what if that you don't get that option again? Like, hopefully your I'll try this is maybe just smoking a clove, like it was when yeah. when I was a teenager, you know, as opposed to maybe I won't love this speedball that I'm about to try out for this one time, you know?
Right. Well, I think that there's definitely instilling the fear of God. That's not useless, you know, like that's still yeah. a part of the equation. There's stuff that you need to be so scared of that you never, ever, ever even consider trying it because it's so scary.
Yeah.
You know, for that very reason, if no other, that, yeah, one time you could just die. And that's
right.
It. Like, whoops. Right. Well, that was what a bummer. Like, now you're dead. Great.
Yeah. That's why things like Scared Straight and what was it? Red Asphalt exist.
Right, right. No, and it's ridiculous to think of that as the only educational tool. You know, because it's a spectrum, as with everything.
Yeah.
Everything is a spectrum. And, but yeah, like the fear of immediate death, that's definitely part of the equation. We all benefit to a certain extent based on the fact that we're alive now.
Right. Right.
We were so scared of certain things that we just didn't do them. And so we didn't die from them. Everything else is a more nuanced conversation.
Anyway. We got out on a very side road there. So you are going through all of those moves as a kid, and your dad is kind of staying put in New Jersey at that point while you guys are doing all of these maneuvers throughout what sounds like the Eastern Coast.
Yes, yeah, it was Eastern Shore of Maryland to Baltimore to couple places in North Carolina, and it was a lot of action packed into a very short period of time. So it was my sister, myself, and my mother getting by, transferring around. She was, you know, jumping from bartending gig to waitressing gig to bartending gig, and eventually landed in extras casting in Wilmington, North Carolina, which it's an interesting industry down there, the film industry. It was a foothold that she was able to snag. And she kind of, you know, stabilized. But leading up to the point where both my sister and I moved to New Jersey with my dad, she had done something called the EST training, which now it's called the Forum. It's basically New Age, self-improvement, you know, self-help seminar kind of that was big with a lot of people who had been through rehab, and 80s culture was big into like self-betterment and like getting to your core self, et cetera, which I don't begrudge. I actually, you know, believe in to an extent, like making yourself better. But she fell in love with a guy who ended up casting a pretty long shadow over our lives for those years. It felt like a lifetime. Basically, as far as I know, took whatever money she had, either inherited or saved or somehow scrounged together. And, you know, he had convinced her that they were going to change the world. That he basically, I liken him to like a cult leader.
Cult. Wow.
Yeah. And it was all painted as like, we're going to teach people how to do self-sustaining farms and zero carbon emission footprint, et cetera, et cetera. And in the meantime, this guy is just a sociopath. And she couldn't afford to have us anymore. So my dad stepped in. At the time, it was supposed to be temporary, where we were just going to go up to New Jersey for a year of school while she got back on her feet. And as it turns out, it was just a better situation for us to be living with some semblance of structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found out, I don't remember ever having a bedtime before living with my dad. I don't remember ever doing homework. I don't remember there being any rules. It was just sort of like, hey, we're alive. You know, now I'm on the beach. Now I'm playing video games. Now it's after dark and I haven't talked to my mom in, you know, for the entire day. I'm just like living, being a kid, living, running around. And when we moved in with my dad, it was like, oh, like you can gain self-confidence from being good at things that you're assigned to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm playing Little League baseball, doing homework.
Like a total different lifestyle, basically.
Yeah, completely different in ways I can't even really quantify, like profoundly different. So dad was out of the picture, and then he was the picture. And we went from spending, you know, every day with our mother to spending summers with our mother.
Mm-hmm.
My sister did eventually end up going back to live with her once she was a freshman in high school. My dad had gotten remarried, and my stepmother had a daughter who was a first grader. I was in fifth grade. Sister was a teenager. And my experience was like, oh, my parents fight a lot, but you know, I'm mostly okay. My sister, on the other hand, she experienced it very differently and felt compelled to move back in with mom for a lot of pretty heavy reasons when we go back through the catalog of things to consider. But yeah. So we were tossed in a bunch of different directions. But dad ended up being, for me at least, a pretty important, or actually a critically important anchor.
Mm-hmm. And then did your mom end up remarrying or marrying at all after that?
No. I'll ask her occasionally, like, mom, like, she's got a pretty unique situation, and she's a pretty unique person in the world. And, you know, I take it for granted. I take for granted a lot of things with her. And then occasionally just a very pedestrian thought will come into my head. Like, why doesn't mom date?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could reach conclusions by thinking about it, about who she is in the world. I'm like, it's so weird to think of mom going on dates, not because it's weird to think of your parents as people who go on dates, but just her as an individual, like, how would you ever get along with anybody? You know, and I asked her, I'm like, mom, why don't you like, you know, get your act together and like go on some dates? Like, are you romantically interested in anyone? She's like, I have been, but you know, everyone's just awful. I'm like, oh no, everyone's awful. That's where you've landed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, she's not a negative person. It's an incredibly negative thing to say or think, but you know, when I think of my mother, I don't think of, you know, a dark cloud. I think she's, maybe I think of a tie-dye rainbow or something. she's flying solo through until further notice.
And so then it's you and your dad and your stepmom and your new stepsister through to your high school years.
So fourth grade until up through eighth grade, it was a fairly stable existence. I think it was the longest I'd ever lived in one place it's the longest I ever had a nuclear family arrangement, you know, and it was normal, like middle school, like running cross country, playing baseball, learning about skateboarding, not doing drugs, but learning about the stuff and not really being in any immediate mortal danger. And I went to North Carolina for the summer before freshman year and came back and found out that we had moved and that they were getting a divorce, which when I think about it now, and for a moment, I lamented the loss of my relationship with my stepsister because we were buddies and my stepmom, she was great, but you know, parental figures had kind of come into and out of the picture, you know, mom's boyfriends at whatever time had come into and out of the picture, usually with more fanfare than that which was present during this divorce process and moving process. So it was pretty unremarkable. I'm like, okay, well, now we live in this other town close to the town we just lived in. That's no longer my stepmother, but I'm really bummed I'm not going to see my stepsister. But you know, going to high school was exciting, and there was enough to distract me from whatever I was supposed to feel worse about through that whole process.
Yeah.
And you know, I guess chalk it up to the naive resilience of younger people. I think there's a lot of stuff that I am not pissed off about today, because at the time, whenever whatever upheaval was taking place or whatever tragedy was taking place, the overarching feeling was that it was a crazy adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never felt like I was, I mean, I won't say I never felt like I wasn't in danger, because there were definitely moments where I thought like, oh man, I definitely should have just died. But for the most part, I am spared the burden of resentment, and my parents have been spared the burden of my resentment, because mm-hmm. I did, for the most part, feel loved.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Mom was eccentric, and it was crazy, and all this crazy stuff was happening, but it was super fun. You know, like, we were human props in her like improv troupe, and it was like really dark humor. you know, like that's I'm not explaining it or doing it justice, because it was absolutely crazy. But you know, for the most part, she was laughing through the entire experience.
Mm-hmm.
When she wasn't crying on the floor, she was mostly laughing through everything, and had a great sense of humor. And so that's what I gravitated toward and picked up on and decided to carry with me, for the most part, was that it was this really fun adventure where, I mean, rules weren't even on the radar. Like, I didn't even know what rules were. It was like, oh, mm-hmm. now I'm doing this crazy thing. Now we're moving here.
Which is kind of, I mean, as a kid, like, you know, obviously you look back at it differently now as an adult, and as a parent, that will also most likely change as well and take a new metamorphosis for you. But as a kid, like, just like you're saying, you were loved through the whole thing, and their response and their reaction and the way that they handled those things potentially made completely a different side of the spectrum for your experience of it than it could have been potentially.
Oh, well, yeah. And even in as like a real time, like, let's consider me the control group in the experiment. You know, my sister had the polar opposite experience, and she deals with it today. She didn't feel loved the entire time. She felt disenfranchised, marginalized, abandoned, betrayed. Mm. And I don't know if it was just that she's wickedly smart,
mm-hmm.
and incredibly sensitive, and basically 2 years older than me. And it might have just been, you know, we were talking earlier about like these things, you reach these intersections in life whenever you do, and you're armed with whatever you got at that time. And she might have just been, you know, I was 2 years younger, so maybe I was just 2 years more oblivious and not picking up on all the nuanced signals that she was, and mm-hmm. internalizing them as deeply. I was kind of rolling with it and being like, all right, whatever, on to the next crazy adventure. And she was, I'm imagining, you know, feeling terrified and uncertain, and, you know, she was 2 years more advanced in her growing up process, that she was scared of different things, attuned to different things. And I think that, you know, despite my oblivious resilience, she was kind of, I think, on the front lines emotionally on a lot of that stuff. And so the bad relationships that, you know, my mother may have had really affected her, and then into the failed relationship that my dad was going through when we moved in with him, you know, I think that really pushed her back into, you know, basically escaping and going back to mom land, where, you know, it might be painful, but at least there aren't any rules to make it more difficult. Mm-hmm. She could be a rebellious teenager and find herself on terms that she would design versus adhering to a family and parental system that is broken anyway, is falling apart, that she can see through. You know, why am I going to follow your rules? You guys don't even love each other. What are you going to teach me?
Right. And she may just have been at that correct, like, even though it was only a 2 year difference, like the ages that she was experiencing them at in comparison, she may just have been at that whether you look at it as the correct age or the incorrect age, that she was having that much different of an experience. Plus, she's a girl. Not to, that sounds super sexist, but that sounds incredibly sexist. But you know what I mean? Like, as I have a little girl and I have a little boy, and again, this is still going to come off as kind of sexist, but let's face it, like, we are from, where are we from? Are we from Venus? Girls are from Mars and men are, boys are from Venus?
No, I think we're Martians.
Men are from Mars. That's right. They're Venetians.
Yes. Which sounds
correct.
Sounds incredibly exotic. Like
Venus.
Yeah.
Venusians, maybe. I don't
Venusians.
Know.
I like Venetians. Like, they're from Venice. Yeah. Girls are from Venice, dude.
Yes.
And California.
We're Martians.
Yeah, we're just idiots.
But like, truly, like, the emotional experience during all of adolescence and prepubescence and pubescence and teen year, I mean, even into adult, it is a different experience emotionally for the most part between the two different genders. And so she very much could have been experiencing that stuff so much differently, especially like somebody who is experiencing these things, whether it is from a dad or from a mom, because of needing that different and not part of her life to be fulfilled, or however you might say it.
Right.
I'm not a psychologist, Tom, but.
No, hey, we're all, you know, what is it? Monday, is it? I don't watch football. Is it? What's the quarterback after it's done?
Oh, Monday morning quarterback.
Yeah, Monday morning quarterback. We're all Monday morning quarterbacks of our own existence and our loved ones' existence. No, I think it's absolutely true that the male and female experience is inherently different to an extent. I think they definitely overlap in many ways. I don't think you're sexist. I think that there's empirical evidence that that lay the foundation of the hypothesis. I think that was definitely part of it. And I think it was a perfect storm at that point in her life, at whatever age you are when you're becoming a freshman in high school, 14, 15. You know, that hormonal crazy time with all these social constructs that you have to live up to or figure out how to abandon and all these things that you're navigating. And I think what really spiked the football for her was that she just had not had any guidance in any shape or form the entire time. You know, I didn't either, but you know, I was younger. I was dealing with lesser elements, lesser life elements. And I think, like, you know, she didn't really get much role modeling from mom outside of like, be yourself and like, be a free spirit, embrace your eccentricities, which is vital, I think. A vital lesson.
Yeah.
But as far as like, how do you do this? How do you do school?
Yeah. How do you push the envelope if you don't know where the envelope is?
Yeah. And she was like, her potential to this day is just so insane. Like, she's so talented and so smart, but you know, just never had parental guidance. And you know, with my dad and his then wife and then my stepsister, you know, it was his wife's daughter, and she definitely had a favorite. You know, this girl was in first grade and was pretty drama free, whereas my sister was a firework, raised by a firework.
Right.
And so there was just,
who's already well established in that. What is your stepmom's ability to, or in her viewpoint potentially, what is her ability to do anything that is a rock, like not clay anymore?
Right. Yeah. And even, and I don't know that this is what she was thinking, but I can imagine even something as simple as like, you know, oh, well, you're divorced. You're divorced and you're marrying my dad. Like, what's your, why do I have to listen to you? Like, you failed
already. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what are you going to teach me? And, you know, to be fair, I don't think she was trying to teach her anything. I think everyone was just kind of swallowing and trying to bury their disdain for the entire equation. And dad, you know, it's so weird, man. Being prepared as a parent, you know, I at 38, I still feel like I'm 17 years old for a number of reasons that makes sense. But just, I think that's just how it goes for some people. You know, I would see pictures of my dad, old photographs of my dad from before I was born, or I would find out it was like the year I was born. And he's like standing in snow and he's got like a jean jacket on and he had like big curly afro. You know, he weighed like 135 pounds, had a mustache, but he looked like dad. He looked like a dad.
Yeah.
You know, he's a child. He's 22 or 23 or whatever, early 20s. He's a know-nothing child who has a wife, a marriage, two kids, and has to figure that out. And, you know, I was in my, I'd be in my like late 20s and I'd stumble across a picture and I would think, man, like, when am I going to start looking like dad? Mm-hmm. When am I going to start looking and feeling like an adult?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it leads you to do stupid things like grow a big beard. And
let's not get crazy. There's nothing wrong with growing a big beard, Tom.
Hey, the 6 months it took me to grow a beard, I fully enjoyed every moment. It did nothing for my emotional fortitude or sense of capability. It did accelerate my physical aging.
Right. Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I recall before I had the beard, I used to kind of, it sounds ridiculous and maybe narcissistic, but I used to kind of look like a semi-attractive girl.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, you know, like cops and homeless people would be like, hey, ma'am, where'd you get that hat? I'll be like, oh, gosh. I got it at Target. Hey, man.
Got it at the man shop.
Yeah, yeah. Where do dads get their clothes?
Yeah.
And from that point in my life to like this existential crisis of like, when am I going to feel like a capable adult?
Mm-hmm.
I was touring with my band and in a bad relationship and was like, well, I don't really have many people to impress. I've got time to like go down this rabbit hole where I grow this stupid beard and who knows, like maybe I'll learn something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grow this dumb beard for 6 months. And then finally I'm like, look in the mirror. I'm like, okay, I kind of look older. I don't look like a semi-attractive girl. I look like a not so manly man with a dumb beard. I can shave this off. And I shaved it off. And I was like, my immediate thought was, oh no, like the physical gravity of the beard pulled my face down and I'm melting. Like I accelerated my aging process. Anyway, I digress, but no, you know, like part of the reason I can't be really mad at my parents is I've at 38, like I think, well, you guys did this 10 years before I did it.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I was the age that you were, when you had children, like I wasn't capable of doing anything.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like I was for all intents and purposes, a middle school kid mm-hmm. who got lucky, you know, with the music stuff, like the system that I had built around myself. Like I didn't have to learn how to be an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I take anytime I feel like getting pissed in my own mind at one of my parents, I think, man, you guys were armed with less information, raised by parents who were going off of even worse information mm-hmm. and stricter cultural norms that didn't necessarily facilitate, you know, a loving relationship with your parents. I mean, our parents were rebelling against their parents and rebelling against the entire country at the time. So like that says a lot about who was raising them. And so, yeah, everyone kind of gets a pass in my book to a certain extent as far as how do you be a good parent?
And when it comes down to it, really, like just kind of like you touched on a little bit there, you can't be prepared for any of this. No, even with all of the information that we have. And for me, a lot of that really, really hit home when we had my daughter because she is extremely high functioning. So, but she is autistic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of had to throw out like half the ideas and plans and things that we thought we knew or were ready for because it was just basically garbage at that point because we had to learn a completely different way, let alone the fact that all of the stuff that we read and ingest and hear from other people and try to do to prepare, like every kid is different and every parent is different. And there is, you know, it's the human factor. And you have to do what works for your kids. I've talked with so many parents, so many young parents about this, and had so many, not saying that, again, I don't even play a psychologist on TV, but I talk to a lot of parents, obviously, because of this podcast, but as well, like, I know a lot of people at that age. And there, the one big thing, I think, one of the major things is the fear of allowing your child into your bed and the wanting to kick your child out of your bed. And that was a big thing for my wife and I, because we were like so many other people, like, there's no way we're doing that. We are not going to let our kids be in bed with us. But if you're, if it's between you and your child potentially getting solid nights of sleep and you being completely at your wit's end for potentially months on end because you're not getting any sleep, and the same with your kid who doesn't really understand the logic of what you're trying to tell them about, you're tired and this is why this is happening and whatever, like, you kind of have to make things work sometimes so that you can be as healthy and helpful and stable as possible too. So
yeah, it's pure survival. Honestly, and I don't mean to sound melodramatic, but that is what it feels like. My wife and I were the same. We're like, okay, we're going to have healthy boundaries. We're going to teach this kid. You know, my wife comes from a family where, you know, they were raised the most important with the tenet that the most important thing you can do for your child is to teach them how not to need you as soon as possible, which I get. Like, yeah, you want your child to be to grow into a strong, autonomous, self-sufficient being who doesn't drain everyone around them. I've been a drain on my dad until, I think probably this year, maybe. You know, I never learned that. No, but it really is survival. Because if you're not sleeping, if you're sleep deprived, and I've actually got a story for you about that specifically. If you're sleep deprived and you're just zombieing your way through daily existence, which I think you have to kind of go through, that's inevitable. But at a certain point, it becomes unsustainable. And then you got to kick into survival mode. And, you know, I read all the books. And the first thing I forgot how to do, that was probably the most well-studied subject, was how to do the swaddle.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, it's a gift.
I was so amped to swaddle my kid for the first time. And I went to do it, and I'm like, well, which is what's left? What's right?
Right. How many triangles am I supposed to have in this blanket? Yeah.
So many triangles. And even, you know, and this is a quick aside, but like systemically, like the nurses who are the most well-meaning and like trained and like wonderful people, we had wonderful nurses, but we were in the hospital for a number of days and had a handful of nurses. They all work at the same place. They all have completely conflicting concept of like proper procedure.
Yep.
I'm like, oh, so everyone is just making it up. Even the most educated, prepared, you know, trained, well-trained specialists are kind of just making it up, a human factor. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we just got our son a big boy bed. He was in a crib that he mostly rejected. The sleep deprivation was so intense that we just found ourselves like, okay, it started with like me going in to get to like, you know, fix him, change his diaper, whatever it was, and put him back down to sleep. And then it turned into, okay, well, if I get up now at 1, you know, I'm going to go back into bed and then get up every hour.
Right.
And my wife isn't going to get any sleep, and the whole family unit's going to just like disintegrate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we just went to like, okay, well, we'll keep trying, but if it's dire, this kid's going to sleep in between us, which is not something that we had wanted to do.
Right.
And it turns out he's flourishing. He's a strong, independent, like well-developed 18-month-old. And I don't mean to advocate for one practice over the other, but you know, when he wakes up in the middle of the night, there's all this stuff that we see that we wouldn't otherwise see. Like we know our kid, in a way, like he wakes up and he's got these funny jokes he's telling in his sleep or as he's waking up, these little colors of his personality that would happen, you know, at best we would catch it through the baby monitor. And so, you know, we still know the cautionary tales. We still have an eye toward, you know, what we're told is responsible parenting. We still strive to like do what we identify as the right thing, but you have to kind of give, you kind of have to give up the ghost on certain child rearing topics if it's right for your family unit.
Right.
If you have to go to work the next day or you have to perform or do something important, even just be there for your kid in the morning while he's wide awake, you know, sometimes that means you're all sleeping next to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. There aren't many kids who are 18 years old still sleeping in bed with their parents. So like,
no, that's the other thing. Like these,
you don't have to fear that.
Yeah. Kids are resilient and they'll reach equilibrium on their own in a lot of respects. When my friends and family found out that we were having a child, you know, and friends with kids, they would say, get ready because you'll never be as exhausted as you are when you have your first child.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was a year and a half ago, a little over a year and a half ago, or whatever it was, 2 years ago when we were having these conversations. And I was super cavalier about it. I was thinking like, I've been in a touring band for the last, you know, 15 years. I stay up past my bedtime all the time. Like, I know about staying up late and being tired. Like, I got this.
Yeah.
And it turned into, I was so tired. I was laying in bed with my wife and like Law and Order was on. And it was like week two or three. And she was still breastfeeding. And she said to me, the way I remember it, she says, hey, Tom, can you run down to the kitchen and get some pump parts? Get some of the gear. Like my poor wife, she had like the gear that she had throughout this whole process. So many things to plug into. And I remember it as, hey, Tom, can you please snore, 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 snore? I fell asleep. And so I snap to, I wake up and I think to myself, oh, that's so rude.
Mm-hmm.
My wife has been going through this and I can't stay awake long enough to like help her. I heard breast pump parts. I'm going to run downstairs and get them. So I get out of bed, walk around the bed, go out the door, close the door behind me. And it's like sort of a long, dark hallway to the door at the top of the stairs. And as I'm walking down the hallway, I essentially fall asleep on my feet. And so I'm fully sleepwalking on this, you know, the task at hand is completely lost. I'm sleepwalking and I start dreaming that I'm in my kitchen and I'm hungry, which is not new. I've been sleep eating since high school. So it's like, I'm not alarmed. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
There's some fried chicken on the counter. I'm going to eat it. So in my dream, I grab the fried chicken, I take a bite and I think, wow, this fried chicken really tastes like blueberries. And it sort of shakes me a little and I start waking up and it turns out that I am in fact in my kitchen in the middle of the night and I'm not eating chicken, but I'm eating a blueberry muffin. And my brain is like slowly turning on. I'm like, okay, that makes sense. You're just sleep eating.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blueberry muffin, but the kitchen's filled with smoke. What's that about?
Oh, geez.
And I start kind of like looking around left to right and I turn around and on the stove is my wife's laptop on the burner on high. I had taken her laptop and started cooking it.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And it was filling up the whole house with smoke. And I snap out of it and run over, grab the laptop, just as the sprinklers, not the sprinklers, but the smoke alarms go off. I burn all my fingertips.
Ugh.
Wife, you know, 3 week old baby breathing in burnt computer fumes upstairs.
Right.
Yeah. Potentially tragic mess ups.
Yeah.
And like fatal errors potentially. And it was because of sleep deprivation. And so, yeah, if you got to snuggle with your kid safely,
yes,
you know, figure out the mechanism to keep your kid from being rolled over on.
Yeah.
But you know, safeguard the family bed. And if you have to do that until you're not a crazy person, you know, basically it's a miracle anyone survives. And I only insofar as these one-off events happen, like cooking your laptop or these life lessons that you learn for the first time once. I still feel unprepared to be a father, but I know that I fixed the problem that happened yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, and my kid is happy.
It's day to day. It's phase to phase. It's school year to school year. You know, it just ends up becoming a different thing that they're going through that you're trying to assist them with and make it through on your own as well. You know, we became very attached to the mantra of this too shall pass, because we knew like our kid is teething and is growing, unfortunately, 5 teeth at once right now. And this is going to be complete hell for however long that takes. And it's going to suck really bad for a little while, and then it's going to stop.
Yeah. And then something else will happen.
Exactly.
And yeah, try and laugh. Like, God, man, sense of humor is so vital.
Yes, totally.
Like when your kid has thrown up in your mouth and peed on you and pooped on you while you're trying to put him in the bathtub, it's like, well, this is, I wish this was in a Steve Martin movie I grew up watching. Like,
totally. Which it was.
It's hilarious. It was it? Oh, it was. Parenthood. It was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Parenthood.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know how parents with 2 kids do it, let alone, you know, you were raised with, what would you say, youngest of 8?
Youngest of 8.
Yeah. Like,
I'm the same way. I look at parents that have anything over than 2, and I'm like, first of all, what have you done?
Yeah.
and second of all, like, how do you do, like, you're outmanned.
One, like, just literally, like,
yeah, you are outmanned, like,
on a binary level,
right? Yeah, so one of you is holding one and one of you is holding the other. What's that third, fourth, fifth, however manyth child doing, and who is handling them, and whatever? So
it's like, you can't just use your feet,
right? Like, right, yeah, you can to push him out the door and stuff like that. Exactly. That's about it.
You're supposed to do that when he's 18, when they're 18.
Yeah, exactly.
They say that it's been scientifically proven that 3 children is on every level the most stressful version of child rearing. Like, you could have 8 kids, but 3 is like the magic number for like level of impossibility. And that's apropos of nothing, but
yeah. But stay away from 3. You have, once you have, I have heard that from some people that said, like, once they went beyond 3, it was no different than 3. Like, once they had 5,
right,
it was the same thing as having 3. And I was like, okay, but there are 2 more. You're aware of that, right? Like,
right,
it's simple math.
I'm hoping that at some point you just kind of have a facility in place. Like, you've got like a manned facility and your house is no longer a home. It's like a place where everybody shows up to work to make the place run.
You know, like small
upper management
factory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mid-level management. And then the seasonal help at the level. Yeah. I don't know. Would you have fallen into like,
I would have been seasonal help hire? Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the busy for holiday seasons.
Yeah. Well, I think the general synopsis of this conversation with you is that parenting is completely a unique situation for every family. I think that that's such an important thing for people to remember and grasp. And I kind of joke around, and I have actually apologized to some of our friends post haste that before we had kids, when we had friends who did have kids, and we would be like at a barbecue or something like that in the afternoon, and they would say, we have to leave because my kid has to take a nap. And we would, you know, kind of gently, oh, just stay, like, they can stay away.
Just stick in the mud.
Yeah. And they would be like, no, we have to stick to their schedule. And we would be like, that after they would leave, you know, all of us non-parents at that point would be like, that's so dumb. Like, when we have kids, we're not going to, you know, we're in charge, like, not their schedule. That's you just let them stay up longer or whatever. And now, you know, I've apologized to them since and said, I get it. I completely understand. And kudos to you for even having some kind of schedule like that. But I know what it is like to have my kid who is just beside themselves tired, and what that means for the rest of your day and or possibly next 2 days, that you can leave a barbecue a little bit early to keep that from happening.
Well, and like you go, once you have a kid, like you go from taking certain things for granted and having your vision, your like perfect vision about how you would do it. You go from that sort of cavalier attitude to thank you for having gone before me. Thank you for any knowledge that you could provide me on how you did X, Y, and Z. Like, I'm sorry for being, you know, silently judgmental of you being tethered to this miracle that I was seeing as an inconvenience for you. Yeah, like it's a weird tribe.
Yes.
the parental tribe, you know, and it is really a lot of make it up as you go, because like we touched on before, the people, you know, the proverbial they have conflicting messaging about how you're supposed to do it. You know, our parents and theirs before them probably didn't do a very good job of arming them with the right information or even helpful information on how to do it. Like my parents didn't tell me anything about having babies.
Right.
You know, and so it is a case by case, experience by experience, moment to moment, daily discovery. And it sounds, I'll reference my EST training, which teaches you to be here now. You can't not, like, you are the daily experience of having a child, as far as I've gone through it, is you're constantly pulled back into the intensity of whatever they're showing you, or whatever they're hurting themselves, or saying something for the first time. Like every experience really is this like very vivid call to being exactly there in that moment. That's true. and then I go back into like being a zombie and completely unconscious.
First step.
Yeah, exactly.
and it is one of those things too, I think, that a lot of this, we will never know so many things about how we did or how we are doing for 20, 30 years down the road, you know, because your kid could tell you when they're your current age, like, hey, thanks for everything that you did, and thanks for teaching me this, or it may just be in a lot of ways evident in some of the choices and decisions that they make, etc. So
right, yeah, well, and taking personal responsibility for like getting your, I don't know if you can, you curse on the podcast,
you can curse. I put the little red E on there just, okay, just to make it available.
Yeah, I've got some explicit content.
Bring it.
No, just for getting your shit together, you know, even as far as like future careers, or you know, I want to, you know, I had this moment where I'm like, crap, my kid's one day going to like wake up and be like, what does daddy do for a living? You know, like we have a pretty, I mean, I bet it's probably more common than I'm aware of, but I, out of college, have been doing music for my living for, you know, since 2001. And my wife, you know, is a partner at a law firm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her job is 9 to 5 every day, and my job is like 4 months out of the year.
Right.
In a lot of ways, like I'm Mr. Mom. And you know, as long as the band is going, like I make good income, but it's non-traditional, which is, I think, is probably an exciting lesson to teach your child. But also at some point it's like, I'm going to have to roll this into something else,
right,
or figure
right.
out something else altogether. And cause if I don't, who knows what if I don't, but I know he's at some point going to be like, well, what does dad do for a living? And I don't want him to think you just can't do nothing. Like, obviously there's something, you know, future anxiety, like it's fine now, but these, yeah, just get your, everyone has to get their shit together. And that's what these people, you know, you don't want to put too much responsibility on them, but this is one that you can just by proxy, like, yeah, this person exists, therefore you need to exist at a different level than you're used to.
Yeah.
And maybe that's becoming an adult I don't know if you ever, whoever feels prepared for whatever those next steps are. I certainly never have gone into a new endeavor with like confidence, like I'm going to nail this like an adult. Mm-hmm. I'm going to like hit home runs. It's like, I'm not prepared to do any.
Right. Right.
But I, you know, and I have a child. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, it loops back around to like, you know, my dad was an accountant. He wanted to be a photographer. He was to an extent. I'm sure he never felt like he was hitting home runs. Mm-hmm. You know, he went through a divorce with two kids.
Right.
When does that confidence descend upon you? And I'm starting to realize it's like, oh, it's just some shit you got to make up.
And what do you, you know, what do you get the fulfillment from in your life? As you're saying, like he wanted to be a photographer and kind of was, and was being an accountant and was right. a dad, but also going through these divorces. Where is his feeling of success and fulfillment coming from? What is he bleeding it out of?
Well, I think, I mean, they lived in a old post office when they were married. He built a dark room, like was doing photography, and then two kids arrived, my sister and I. He went to work for his dad as an accountant and was miserable. And I try and piece that together too, because, you know, since then, 30 years later, he's been selling office furniture mm-hmm. and doing great. Mm-hmm. But as far as I can tell, he gleans inspiration and happiness and fulfillment from having, not to make this about me, but you know, like
you are on the title of the episode though, Tom.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I suppose so. Yeah, I can do that. no, I think he gets a lot of fulfillment out of like, I don't want to say simple, cause I'm sure there were really hard won, but regular successes about that come with raising good people. And like, I don't know if it comes from the mechanics of selling office furniture or whatever, but just having good relationships with people.
No, that's absolutely, I may never have to record another episode again, because basically you just nailed it. When everything comes down to it, I've said this in a number of different ways and with a number of different people, but like as cheesy and cliche and completely saccharine layered that this can be, like when it all comes down to it with everything, it comes down to our relationships. And for us as parents, what have we done with our children?
Yeah.
Not only activity wise, but how did we raise them, and what kind of kids and adults and people contributing to society and loving other people, like what did we do to assist with that and whatever. So
I just want to get by, make some art, and like be a good person and enrich other people's lives. Mm-hmm. And you know, love authentically and don't hurt anybody. And I married the love of my life, and as long as, you know, and this might be naive as well, but as long as there's some real fortifying emotional content to cultivate with another person or people for that matter. Yeah. Maybe I work at the sign store mm-hmm. for that's what I'm qualified to do until I cultivate some other skills. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that ends my first half of the conversation with Tom Keeley. I apologize. It's kind of a funky edit because we just kind of sat down and started chatting and it just kind of went from there. So I didn't want to break up the flow of the conversation by trying to insert all of the podcast ins and outs. But I'm very excited to have you all hear the second half of that conversation that will come out. I'm shooting for next week. I know I usually do releases every other week, but I'm shooting for next week because I've got something big happening the week of February 20th for the podcast that I can't really announce yet, but I'm trying to get this all out in the correct amount of time because of that. So keep your eyes open for that. Again, you can find Tom on Twitter. He's not incredibly active. Maybe he'll get more active, but on Twitter he is Tom Thurs. And the band Thursday is on Twitter as Thursday Band. And you should check out Thursday.net to see they are back on tour. They have a ton of dates coming up this year. So make sure you check them out. See if you're able to catch them in your area this year. Again, as always, you can find Daddy Unscripted on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, all as Daddy Unscripted. The website is daddyunscripted.com, and you can send me emails at daddyunscripted@gmail.com. I've been doing a couple of giveaways lately. I think I'll do one with his next episode of a giveaway of some type of Thursday product. So thanks again for listening, you guys, and keep an eye out hopefully next week for my second half of my episode with Tom Keeley.